From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Chris Whipple, a writer, a documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Gatekeepers: How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Since George Washington, American presidents have always depended on advice of key confidants. But it wasn't until the 20th century that the White House chief of staff became the second most powerful job in the government. Despite the tremendous power that the chief of staff wields, the framers of the U.S. Constitution never envisioned a position quite like it. The chief of staff, or gatekeeper to the president, is unelected and unconfirmed. He or she serves at the whim of the president, who can hire and fire him or her alone. In his book, The Gatekeepers: How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, Whipple pulls back the curtain to expose how these right-hand advisors operate, the nation's levers of power, and the extent to which they make a difference between success and failure in every presidency. Whipple conducted interviews with all 17 living chiefs of staff and two former presidents, Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush. As President Trump, the consummate outsider, tries to govern after a divisive election, we'll ask Mr. Whipple how he assesses the Trump White House, known for competing power centers, and to what extent this either hinders or helps a maverick president. Chris Whipple has won multiple Peabody and Emmy Awards for his outstanding work in media. He has been praised for his detailed research for the groundbreaking film, The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, which included exclusive interviews with all 12 living CIA directors and their top operatives. And Chris Whipple joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Chris Whipple, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're really delighted to have you on this very important topic. So you argue, Chris Whipple, in your book that this unelected and unconfirmed position, chief of staff, can literally make or break a presidency, can actually define the difference between a success and failure. How so?
You know, it's fascinating because there's nothing in the Constitution about a White House chief of staff. As you pointed out, he is hired and fired by the president alone, unconfirmed. And yet, the White House chief of staff really is, according to James Baker, who ought to know, Ronald Reagan's quintessential chief, he's the second most powerful position in government. Dick Cheney, who also ought to know something about it, having been Gerry Ford's White House chief when he was 34 years old, long before he became George W.'s powerful vice president, he says the White House chief of staff has more power than the vice president. What Cheney doesn't often add is that that's true except when Cheney was vice president. But it really is impossible to imagine governing effectively in the modern era without having an empowered White House chief of staff for a whole host of reasons, which is what the book is about.
Indeed. And what is the one quality, in your view, that an excellent chief of staff must have?
I would say a first-class temperament. You know, if you think about two of the most effective White House chiefs in history, James A. Baker III under Ronald Reagan during Reagan's first term, and Leon Panetta, who came in a year and a half into Bill Clinton's White House and became his very effective White House chief of staff. Those guys had something in common. They were, first of all, guys who had been around the block. They'd had some experience. Jim Baker was 50 years old when he became Reagan's White House chief. He was comfortable in his own skin. He could walk into the Oval Office, close the door behind him, and tell Ronald Reagan what Reagan did not want to hear. Panetta could do the same thing with Bill Clinton. Not easy with a guy like Bill Clinton. But that's a critical job duty. It's a job requirement. And it requires a person who is comfortable in his own skin.
Well, that leads me to ask you, Chris Whipple, about the current president, President Donald Trump. Because talk about temperament, he has a specific temperament. It's not one that lends itself to listening to someone telling him what he doesn't want to hear. So how does that makes
Here's the bottom line. In my opinion, having studied the last 50 years of presidential history and interviewed every living White House chief who preceded Reince Priebus, the current chief of staff, every president learns often the hard way that you cannot govern effectively without empowering your White House chief of staff as first among equals in the White House to do a whole host of things, but most importantly, to execute your agenda and to tell you what you don't want to hear. Quite frankly, that's not happening in this White House. This White House, I think, is struggling mightily on so many fronts, beginning with executive orders that are unenforceable, the inability to really craft coherent legislation, a complete failure to prioritize the president's agenda, the failure to communicate. All of those things in a normal White House flow from an empowered White House chief of staff who can execute the president's agenda. And unfortunately, that's just not happening. And one of the reasons it's not happening, in my opinion, is that you can't run the White House the way you run a Manhattan real estate firm with a whole bunch of advisors coming and going and no chain of command and nobody empowered to carry out your agenda.
Well, that leads me to ask you to what extent you think this lack of empowering of Reince Priebus on the part of President Trump, these various competing centers of power, we know his campaign advisor Steve Bannon versus Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who's also a White House advisor, to what extent is this maybe part of the plan, the very decentralized nature of it? And if so, you know, what does that say?
Well, what it says is it's a terrible plan. History's littered with the wreckage of presidencies that didn't understand that you have to empower a White House chief. And I think that one chief of staff put it to me this way. You know, presidents come into power full of hubris, intoxicated by victory, often thinking they have all the answers. And sometimes the attitude toward their predecessors is, hey, if you guys are so smart, how come we beat you? So they don't really want to listen to the lessons that their predecessors often try to impart to them. You know, Jerry Ford, when he became president, thought he could run the White House by himself. He had all of his advisors coming and going with equal access. He called it the spokes of the wheel, with Ford at the center. And it was a disaster. It took a month for Ford to figure that out. And then he begged his old friend Donald Rumsfeld, who was then ambassador to NATO, to come in and really run the White House with an iron fist, which is what Don Rumsfeld did, and he really turned the Ford White House around. Every president learns this lesson, and some of them intuit it when they come in. Ronald Reagan, who was famously not nearly as smart, perhaps, as his predecessor, Jimmy Carter, on paper, nevertheless intuited that he needed, that an outsider president needs a consummate insider to make things work on Capitol Hill, to run a White House effectively. He found that person in James A. Baker III. So sometimes presidents understand it, sometimes they have to learn it. It's clear that Donald Trump has not learned this yet.
Indeed. I have to say, I really enjoyed the chapter about Gerald Ford, who of course took over after Nixon's resignation, his resignation over the Watergate scandal. And the part where you said he finally sort of learned the importance of having a chief of staff when, and I'd like you to describe this or tell this story about how Donald Rumsfeld told him not to attend the birthday party of one of his friends on Capitol Hill, Tip O'Neill, a Democrat.
Yeah, you know, it's not always the major affairs of state. Sometimes it's the little things that trip up presidents. In this case, Jerry Ford had been invited to a birthday party for his pal, Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House. He was dying to go to this party. The problem was Don Rumsfeld, his chief of staff, figured out that it was being thrown by a shady character, a lobbyist by the name of Tong Son Park, and he was under investigation. And Rumsfeld thought this could put the president in a compromising situation. He told Ford, "You're not going to the party." Ford was adamant. He said, "Tip O'Neill is my pal. I'm going to the party." Rumsfeld said, "Fine, you're going to walk. There will be no security for you. There will be no transportation for you. There will be no Secret Service. You're going to have to get there on your own." Guess what? Jerry Ford sent his regrets to Tip O'Neill. And in the end, Rumsfeld was absolutely right. Park was indicted on any number of counts. It became a huge scandal in Washington. And so, you know, Gerry Ford was the kind of guy who saw the best in everybody. He was a genial, outgoing guy. It was Rumsfeld's job as chief of staff to suspect the worst.
Once again, Chris Whipple, that leads me to ask you about Mr. Trump and bring this story back to the present, because it's hard for me to imagine Reince Priebus, the current chief of staff, telling Mr. Trump not to do something that he wants to do and the consequences of that.
I got to say, I mean, you need look no further than that incredible cabinet meeting recently in which everybody, including the chief of staff, competed to see who could be more obsequious in front of the boss. That was not exactly a profile in courage or the picture of a White House chief who can tell the president hard truths. In my opinion, Priebus has really failed in that respect. I've heard of no examples where he's really been able to tell the president what he didn't want to hear. And that's, as James Baker or Leon Panetta will tell you, that's job number one. That's job requirement number one, is being able to do that. So I think on that level, Priebus has failed as White House chief. And I think that the White House itself is really broken. I mean, if you look at it, it's, as I said before, it seems unable to even issue executive orders that are enforceable. It can't get legislation through more than one chamber, at least so far. It doesn't seem to be able to communicate. All of those things flow from an empowered chief of staff. And in fairness to Priebus, I really should say that there's almost nothing any White House chief of staff can do if the president doesn't empower him as first among equals. And that has not happened.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Chris Whipple. He's an acclaimed writer and filmmaker and author of the new book, The Gatekeepers: How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Ai Nien Tu from Thailand. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, now back to our special guest, Chris Whipple, author of The Gatekeepers, about White House Chiefs of Staff. So, Chris, let's go back and actually define the job for the 21st century. We've witnessed, obviously, a number of presidents. You talked about President Carter. We have Obama. But talk about particularly how the 24-hour news cycle and the age of social media, Twitter and Facebook and so forth, have actually made the job all the more complicated.
Well, there's no question about it that the modern era of Twitter and social media has made the job exponentially more difficult than it's ever been. But to define the job, you really have to think about it. Not only is the White House chief the president's closest confidant, or should be, the White House chief is famously the gatekeeper who controls access to the Oval Office. And what that really does is it gives a president time and space to think. In addition to that, he's the person who controls the flow of information to the president, who makes sure that every decision is teed up with information on every side of that decision, and also making sure that only the toughest decisions get into the Oval Office. He is the person who is in charge of the daily message, who makes sure that everybody in the administration is speaking on the same page. If none of this sounds familiar, it's precisely because the White House chief of staff has not been empowered to do any of these things in the current White House. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing such a dysfunctional White House. At the end of the day, the White House chief is also the person who is in charge of executing the agenda. That means knowing how many votes are on Capitol Hill for any given piece of legislation. And it means, you know, you can have in every White House all kinds of debates, and you can even have ideological division. You can have advisors arguing, battling for the soul of the presidency. All of that is fine. But at the end of the day, when the president makes a decision, everybody needs to fall in behind the White House chief and execute the agenda. That's how critical the job is.
I believe in the book you talked about H.R. Haldeman, who, of course, was the disgraced chief of staff for President Nixon, who, of course, resigned as a result of the Watergate scandal, as sort of a modern template for chief of staff. Talk about that. Talk about an example of a successful chief of staff.
Well, H.R. Haldeman is a fascinating case because, on the one hand, as you mentioned, he became the symbol of the biggest scandal in American political history, Watergate. And Haldeman was ultimately undone by his inability to speak truth to Nixon when the Watergate scandal closed in on them. But the irony is that Haldeman is the guy who almost all of his successors will tell you really created the template for the modern, empowered White House chief of staff. All of those duties, all of those functions that I was just talking about a minute ago, were really the model that Haldeman created. So he's a fascinating character because he had that fatal flaw, and yet he did create a kind of template that presidents have strayed from at their peril ever since. As I said before, Gerry Ford tried to do it very much the way Donald Trump is trying to do it now, without a chain of command, without anybody who's empowered as first among equals. It was a disaster. Within a month, Ford had to change it. Jimmy Carter, who was possibly the most intelligent president of the 20th century, at least on paper, Jimmy Carter was trained as a nuclear engineer, and yet he did not understand that you need a White House chief to help you run your White House. He thought he could do it by himself. He didn't appoint a chief of staff until 2.5 years into his presidency. It was really too late at that point for the chief to rescue the Carter administration, and no doubt he was dealt a very tough hand with a hostage crisis in Iran and OPEC and everything else. But Carter is a cautionary tale for presidents who try to run the White House by themselves. Bill Clinton was fascinating, and, you know, I tell his story in the book. He spent almost all of his time choosing his cabinet, almost none of his time picking his White House staff, which is more important. At the very last minute, he chose a childhood friend, Thomas F. McLarty, Mac McLarty, very capable, very smart guy, talented businessman. But Mac McLarty had no experience in Washington. He didn't really know how the place operated. And, you know, about a year and a half in, Clinton was really dead in the water. I mean, he was stalled. He was caught up in the Whitewater scandal and the so-called Travelgate mess. And there was practically an intervention that was launched, staged by Hillary Clinton and Al Gore. They went to Clinton and they said, listen, you are in deep trouble. You really need to make a change. You need to empower a White House chief of staff to turn things around. They chose Leon Panetta, flew him to Camp David, virtually locked him in a cabin with Bill Clinton and Al Gore and Tipper Gore and Hillary. And as Leon put it to me, I knew it wasn't going to be a fair fight. He wanted to be OMB director. When he left that cabin, he was White House chief of staff. And he, with help from Erskine Bowles, who was a brilliant businessman and organizational genius, they really turned that Clinton White House around. I think it's a real possibility that Bill Clinton could have been a one-term president if not for the way Leon Panetta came in with help from Erskine Bowles and John Podesta, who was also a deputy chief, and they turned that White House around.
Well, that's really interesting because we know also John Podesta, well, he served in the Obama administration, not as chief of staff, but Leon Panetta served as
CIA director and defense secretary
under
Obama later on, yeah.
Right. He's quite an important man in the last decade. Well, speaking of OMB director, you mentioned in the book that three budget directors have gone on to become chiefs of staff, and that was most recently Jack Lew. That was Obama's third chief of staff. What about, in your view, being the OMB director prepares someone for this job?
I think it's great training. It's hard to really say that there's any one way to prepare to become White House chief of staff. There have been a lot of successful chiefs who had different experiences. Jim Baker was never an OMB director, but he was the gold standard as White House chief of staff. But Panetta was, and Josh Bolten was, George W. Bush's second chief of staff. And so was Jack Lew, as you point out. Lew said something interesting to me. He said that, budgets are not about numbers. Budgets are so much more. Budgets are about values. They're about what do we really care about and what do we really, what are we really going to invest in? And when Lew became Barack Obama's White House chief, I think they were very simpatico because they had done a lot of budgets together and they had a kind of a mind meld. But Lew wanted to become Secretary of the Treasury. And so he moved on after a short period and was replaced by Dennis McDonough, who he and Obama were certainly a good fit, a good match as president and White House chief. And he served for quite a long time with Obama.
Well, speaking of serving a long time, I find us making reference to the second, the third, the fourth chief of staff, which leads me to believe that this position has a very short lifespan. I mean, it must be so intense. Is that why they don't stay in the position more than 2 or 3 years?
It's unbelievably relentless, 24/7. You get all of the blame and none of the credit. And there's no question about it. Every chief of staff, if he's smart, the first phone call he makes is to James Baker, who was Reagan's quintessential chief during that first term. And the first thing Baker says to them is, congratulations, you've got the worst job in Washington. It's that tough. Baker burned out. He lasted 4 years, which is way beyond average. The average tenure is about 18 months. That's how grueling and brutal the job can be. And so, yes, a lot of chiefs do burn out after a short period of time. And, I think Andy Card, who was set the modern record, he went for 5 years and 3 months, I believe. Andy Card will tell you that he thinks he stayed too long, that he lost his edge, he lost his effectiveness. Probably, if he had it to do over again, would have left sooner. And in fact, offered George W. Bush his resignation after the first term, and W. chose to keep him on.
Well, Chris Whipple, you may have noticed that in referencing chief of staff in my introduction, I used the word he or she, and yet I can't think of a female chief of staff in our history. And in your book, you mentioned that there actually has never been a female chief of staff to the president. Why do you think that's the case?
It will happen. I mean, there will be a woman as chief of staff eventually. I'm not sure how soon, considering our current president. But I do think it'll happen. If you think about it, how many women have we had as president? How many women have we had as campaign managers? Maybe one. It's part of, unfortunately, it's been part of the political culture. There was a woman who came very close, I think, and was actually a contender to become chief of staff under Obama. Her name was Nancy Ann DeParle. She was really the person behind Obamacare, the policy. I think that she didn't really have the political experience on Capitol Hill, which is why she didn't make the final cut as White House chief, and it went to Dennis McDonough. But it's going to happen one of these days, and it's way overdue.
Well, I had the pleasure of doing a program on White House Chiefs of Staff many, many years ago for the Voice of America. And one of the people I interviewed was Ken Duberstein, of course, who was Ronald Reagan's Chief of Staff. How would you characterize Mr. Duberstein?
I think Ken Duberstein was one of the best. And he's also, he's got a great sense of the history. He's a great storyteller. One of the great things about Duberstein is that he came in with Howard Baker Jr. at the height of the Iran-Contra scandal, when Ronald Reagan was in deep, deep trouble with the scandal in which the administration had been found to be trading arms for hostages to Iran. And there was a real possibility of impeachment. It was in the air, and Reagan was in deep, deep trouble. Duberstein and Howard Baker sat down together, and they made a secret pact, and I tell the story in the book. They decided they would sit Ronald Reagan down, they would talk to him, they would try to find out exactly what he knew about what was happening. And if they decided that Reagan was lying to them, they were going to quit. They would resign. They sat Reagan down. They heard him out. They came away convinced that Reagan was not lying. And they managed ultimately to get him to give a speech in which he took responsibility, essentially apologized for the Iran-Contra scandal. And it really turned American opinion around. It really was an example of a White House chief. In this case, Howard Baker was the chief and Duberstein was the deputy. But it was a case of the White House chief and his deputy having the kind of judgment that Reagan needed at that moment.
And as we conclude, I'd like you also to talk about, you know, maybe any particular interview you had that was most candid, elucidating among these 17 chiefs of staff and the two presidents.
You know, it's hard to choose because they're all, it's a fascinating cast of characters that Aaron Sorkin, you know, couldn't have dreamed up.
And Aaron Sorkin being the...
Aaron Sorkin, the creator of the program, The West Wing, and the great screenwriter, Hollywood screenwriter. It's amazing to me that nobody else had done this book before I got around to it. But the stories are fascinating. The characters are great. And Dick Cheney is one of the best. And I spent a lot of time interviewing Cheney. And the great untold story about him is that when he was Gerald Ford's 34-year-old White House chief of staff, Dick Cheney was, believe it or not, the most popular guy in Washington. He was the toast of the town. He was the life of the party. He was the guy you also wanted in a room when you needed to really hammer out a consensus on a difficult issue. He had this great self-effacing sense of humor, which he actually still has, by the way. His Secret Service code name was Backseat. He was a guy who was an extremely effective White House chief of staff and maybe the most popular, you know, from that day to the present. So it's a great story. And of course, many of the White House chiefs are to this day look at each other and go, what happened to that guy? Dick Cheney. There are a lot of theories. I mean, one is that his heart condition changed his personality. Another is 9/11. Another is when he became CEO of Halliburton, that he somehow went to the dark side. I think Cheney would tell you that he hasn't changed, that the world changed. Yeah. 9/11 had a big influence on him. And I think my own theory is that he's just a guy who had nothing left to prove when he became W's vice president, and he was willing to freely speak his mind.
Right, George W. Bush. Well, do you see any difference between the Democratic and Republican chiefs of staff? Anything that, you know, characterizes one group versus the other, or do they just share, you know, qualities?
Listen, I think party has very little to do with the effectiveness of a chief of staff. And one of the great things about the book, I think, is that I'm really, really able to go right down the middle. And I'm tough on Democrats and tough on Republicans alike. And as I've said before, I think perhaps the two best chiefs in modern history were James Baker, who's a Republican, and Leon Panetta, who's a Democrat. One of the great things about these guys is that they are sometimes fierce partisans ideologically, and yet for every one of them, all 17 living chiefs that I interviewed, I would say that their respect for the office of the presidency transcends their allegiance to the boss. They really believe in the office of the presidency and in making the White House run effectively. And, you know, it was my pleasure to get to know them, and I hope the book does justice to them.
The book is The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. The author, Chris Whipple. Chris, congratulations on a terrific book, and thank you for coming in and sharing your insights.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Zubair El Tayeb. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.